Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Omega-3 fatty acids, more commonly known as fish oil, are one of the most popular and profitable dietary supplements in the United States. Every year, citizens spend $15 billion on omega-3 supplements and omega-3 supplemented products. The omega-3 fish oil market is expected to grow at a rate of 7% per year for the foreseeable future. Omega-3 fatty acids have long been celebrated by doctors and dietitians. You've probably heard all of these claims. They're a key to a healthy heart and a sharper brain. But today's guest, journalist Paul Greenberg, says a closer look at the omega-3 sensation reveals something much deeper and more troubling. In his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet, award-winning journalist Paul Greenberg tells the story of omega-3 fatty acids and how our quest for a healthier life has boiled down trillions of pounds of marine life into animal feed, fertilizer, and dietary supplements. So what is our relationship between the food that we eat and the oceans that sustain us? Paul Greenberg is an award-winning journalist and author of American Catch and the James Beard Award-winning bestseller, Four Fish. His new book is The Omega Principle. And Paul Greenberg joins me in studio. Hi, Paul. Thank you for coming in.
Hey, great to be here.
It's great to have you. I have been wanting someone to write a book about fish oil for a while now because, you know, I have friends who are nutritionists and work on healing, and they always tell people, oh, you just need fish oil.
Yeah.
And then a family member has dry eye, and she was recently told you should either take flax oil or fish oil. So why did you decide to focus on this?
Well, you know, I was 47 when I first started working on this book, and it actually came about kind of as a midlife crisis thing. So, I mean, as you mentioned in your intro, I've been writing about fish and seafood for better part of a decade now. I've been looking at different aspects of the ocean, wild versus farm, domestic versus imported. And I wanted to go beyond just the sort of binary thing of like, are we overfishing the ocean, whatever. I wanted to look at the really essential, almost chemical level of the way the ocean is changing. At the same time, I was having this midlife crisis where my joints were hurting, my heart was beating too fast, I was depressed, I couldn't sleep. And, you know, I did those sort of horrible, dark, deep dives into the internet in the middle of the night. And I don't really like prescription medication. I don't like doctors that much. And so I was looking for alternative things that would possibly cure my problems. And it was interesting, if you type into a search engine, omega-3s may, you get a solution to all your problems. Omega-3s may improve joints, may increase brain size. I love this one, may improve sperm competitiveness. I'm not really sure why I would want my sperm to be more competitive, but anyway, that's what they promised. So there was that. But then there was also, when I started looking into the biological functions of the ocean, the omega-3 turned up all over the place there as well. So I thought it would be really interesting to write a book that would be about human health, but also about ocean and environmental health, and to try and ping back and forth between the two. So that's kind of what launched me on my omega journey.
And it's a fascinating journey. We have done so many shows about overfishing and the health of the oceans and about just how our food choices really affect the environment. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that this is getting so much more attention. And you write that today, in spite of the fact that fish is widely touted for its health benefits, Americans eat only around 15 pounds of fish per year, compared with 210 pounds of land food meat.
Yep.
That's a big difference.
It's a big difference. You know, it came up, actually. I was a few years ago, I was out here, and I had coffee with Michael Pollan. And I think Michael had finished Food Rules. I think he was, you know, still in the height of his food stuff. And I was looking at Michael, and, you know, Michael's like, he was looking really good and really successful. His clothes look good. And, you know, whatever, he's not an ostentatious person at all. But nevertheless, I thought about 210 pounds of land food meat, 15 pounds of seafood. I was like, I wonder if our royalties have played out similarly when you compare. But seriously, it is a huge discrepancy. And when you go back, one of the things I look at a fair bit in the Omega Principle is the Mediterranean diet. And I went back through the very initial studies from the 40s, 50s, and 60s where they looked at Mediterranean patterns of eating. And what did they find? They found very little animal protein, just like Michael, as I always said, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. But when you look at the protein that they were eating, it was about 50-50 seafood and land food. Hmm. So I have really kind of got to the point where I think we need to understand not just omega-3s, but the whole way that we balance our choices of eating, both from the land and the sea.
It's so true. And since you bring up Michael Pollan, I'll never forget the time he was on the show and said, all right, think about this. If you eat carrots, lentils, celeries, herbs, which is pretty much what I eat, the food industry is not making that much money off
That's
of
right.
you.
That's right.
And so what they need to do is box all of that food and slap a bunch of labels on the box, omega-3, protein, high in fiber, and then they make money off of
right.
you.
And that's exactly what the omega-3 supplement is. You know, where are we getting omega-3 supplements from? Primarily from small fish in the from the taxonomic order Clupeiformes. And what are these? These are anchovies, herring, sardines, so forth. Do Americans like those oily fish? Not so much. Would they like to live forever and have better heart health and better brain health? Yes. And so rather than eating the whole fish, which I was pretty convinced of by the time I was finished with all this research, that a whole fish offers such a broad array of nutrients in addition to omega-3s. I was it's hard to package an anchovy in a way that Americans will accept it. A golden little pill, or actually rather large pill, that's a whole other story. So I think that's one of the reasons we've backed ourselves into this, if you will, Pollan-esque nutritionist corner. Mm. And whereas Michael talked about nutritionism in defense of food, I talk a lot about supplementism when it comes to the omega-3 industry.
Let's get some of the basics out of the way.
Yeah.
Omega-3, where does the name omega come from? You have an interesting story about this in your book.
Yeah, so, well, first of all, omega is the last word in the Greek alphabet. So there's alpha and there's omega at either end of it. So the omega-3 is called the omega-3 because omega-3s have double carbon bonds, which make them particularly flexible. I won't go into the I will say that I got a C- in chemistry. and so I tried to bring my chemistry up to about a C+ level. So nobody should be intimidated and think that this is a book about chemistry. But nevertheless, the first double carbon bond in omega-3 comes three carbons in. So that is why it's called the omega-3. And this the person who named them is a guy named Ralph Holman, who actually used to work for the Hormel company that made Spam. Mm-hmm. So he did a lot of research on fats. But he was a Baptist and so went to Bible school as a kid. And he remembered this one quote from Revelations, "I am the Alpha and the Omega." You know, God is saying this. And he just liked the resonance of Omega. And then he said, you know, funnily enough, the word Omega kind of rolls off the tongue. So that's why we have omega-3s, and they're here and they're everywhere.
They definitely are. $15 billion industry every single year. All right, so what are omega-3s?
Well, so they're polyunsaturated fatty acids, which means they have these double carbon bonds, which make them particularly flexible. They were actually invented not by fish. I think a lot of people think, oh, I eat omega-3s because the fish make them. But fish don't make them, actually. They actually were invented by phytoplankton, mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of years ago. Interestingly enough, they were invented as an adaptation to a changing climate, but climate changing in another way. Because when phytoplankton emerged, they sucked all the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and we got cooler. How do you survive in a colder environment? If your cell membranes are stiff and inflexible and non-reactive, you don't do well in a cold environment. So they invented the omega-3, and this has allowed life to spread to the poles. So, you know, there's this other thing, this weird loop in the book, which is the chapter where I talk about all this is called Algae's Tools. And, you know, the first idea in that is that omega-3s are the tools of algae. But the other interesting thing is that all of that algae that created all those omega-3s and, you know, brought in all that sunlight and so forth, fell to the bottom of the ocean over hundreds of millions of years. And what did they turn into? Petroleum. So interestingly enough, now we are burning all that petroleum, changing the atmosphere back to the way it was when algae first started photosynthesizing. So what if we are algae's tools? What if, you know, humans are so haughty and thinking that we control the world, but what if we're just part of a giant carbon cycle run by algae? So that's why algae's tools has a double meaning in the
book. It would be
book.
Good if the algae can take over and set
yeah,
us on the
yeah,
right path.
Algae world.
Let's talk more about the phytoplankton, because this is so important. These are the creatures that really underlie the entire oceanic food system.
That's right.
They're so, so important.
Essential. Half of the world's oxygen is created by phytoplankton, and actually a huge amount of the world's carbon passes through phytoplankton. I mean, it's what makes the ocean this huge carbon sink. You know, we think of trees as carbon sinks. We think of, grasslands and so forth. But the biggest carbon sink by far is the ocean. And we've really pushed it to the limit in that respect. And that was another troubling thing about researching the Omega Principle, was that starting to see these big changes in plankton communities. One study showed a 40% reduction in chlorophyll in the oceans overall. So there's that. And then there's all these, the other thing that makes phytoplankton really important, and I would say all these sort of lower rungs of the food chain important, is that you have the sun, which is where all the energy comes from. We wouldn't exist without the sun. And then we have things like tuna that we like to eat. And we have things like cod and all these, pollock, whatsoever. But the way the solar energy gets to the tuna is via plankton. If nobody is, they're the translators of energy. If nobody is translating the energy of the sun on up to these bigger fish, then there ain't nobody eating nothing. And then there's all these other lower rungs too. So in addition to the phytoplankton, you have these little fish, these anchovies, sardines. They're the clupeiforms. Those are the other translators. They translate algae into fish flesh, which then allow them to be eaten by bigger fish. So all these lower rungs that we never see in the supermarket, that we never see in our lives, that we never think about, they're absolutely essential. And right now we're taking out 25 million metric tons of these little fish every year. 25 million metric tons, which is the human equivalent to the human weight of the United States, all boiled down into fertilizer, animal feed, and yes, dietary supplements.
Today we're speaking with journalist Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Paul has been writing about fish and seafood for a decade now, and this new book focuses on omegas, commonly known as fish oil. This is a $15 billion yearly industry, and it's expected to grow at a rate of 7% per year for the foreseeable future. And this is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. All right, it's hard to wrap your head around 25 million metrics of fish. Metric tons of fish, thank you. I'm sure that a lot of listeners have watched documentaries of the trawlers, where it's like they're in a neighborhood and they're just killing everything in sight, bulldozing down homes, in this case, coral reefs. But can you talk about, first off, 25 million metric tons of fish every single year?
Yep.
How long can that last?
Well, it depends how we're managing the ocean. If we just want those little fish year in and year out, probably we could continue to do that. But if we continue to do that, we're taking fish out of the mouths of all the bigger fish, the whales, the seals, the penguins, and so forth. So if we just wanted to manage for little silvery fish and only have little silvery fish, we probably could keep doing it for a while. If we're wanting to do what is called ecosystem-based management, where we're really thinking about the needs of the entire ecosystem, then we ought to stop tomorrow. Or at least we ought to cut it severely in half. I mean, one of the things I've been advocating for is that, I mean, you're vegan, so maybe I'm not speaking to you as an audience. But
it's okay.
But, you know, people do it. If we were to, instead of boiling down things like anchovies, herring, and so forth into dust and fish oil, if we were to eat them directly, we probably could cut the catch in half and double the price for the fishermen who are doing the fishing. Because when you're fishing for industrial material, you're not getting a lot of money per pound. But if you're fishing for food for people, that's a whole other category. So I mean, I like fishing communities. I think that they're important for coastal stability. I think I'd much rather see a fishing community than a marina with luxury yachts. I mean, that to me is much more balanced.
Right. And also, before we started the show, we were talking about the fact that when you ask that question, when it comes to fish, what should we eat? Well, yep. It really depends on where you live.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're living in a coastal community, you live and die based on how much fish you can catch.
That's right.
If you're living in San Francisco and you have the means, you really don't need to eat fish. I mean, some people could say, yes, you do for your health.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you another question about this 25 million metric tons
yeah.
of fish. How are these little silvery fish caught? And
yeah.
is there any way to specifically just catch those little fish?
Uh-huh.
Or are many, many other fish killed in the process?
So good question. They're primarily caught through something called a purse seine, which basically you find a school of fish. Often they're fished at night, and they'll shine a light into the water, kind of simulate a full moon, and the fish will gather around it, and then they encircle them with a net and pull them all in. As fisheries go, a purse seining for these little silvery fish, these small pelagics as they're called, is actually pretty benign. If we were just targeting them to eat, it's a pretty benign form of fishing insofar as very low carbon, because you're not dragging the bottom. Like you were speaking about, you know, coral reef damage and stuff. When we're dragging the bottom for things like cod and, you know, snapper and rockfish, that does genuine damage to the bottom. But a surface or midwater trawl or purse seine, you're not dragging it over structure. Also, it's very low carbon, again, because you're not dragging over structure. The bycatch, again, these schools of these big fish tend to be somewhat uniform. There's not a huge amount of bycatch involved. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, all of these little fish, if we could think about using them as food instead of animal feed, it's not a bad way to get our protein. And in fact, we were talking a little bit before the show started. There have been a couple of recent studies that have come out recently that have looked at what would be the ideal diet from a carbon perspective. And there's pretty strong evidence that suggests that a diet where you have limited animal protein, but animal protein that's coming from things like these small pelagics or, for example, farmed mussels, clams, and oysters, mm-hmm. that actually, on a carbon basis, can outcompete a vegan diet,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was pretty interesting.
It is interesting. And also, like we said, there are lots of junk food vegans who
sure.
eat lots of fake meats and things.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
that's, and lots of soy. That's higher on the carbon list.
Absolutely.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, if you just eat whole foods, I would imagine that the vegan diet comes out better. But nevertheless, with these little pelagic fish, nobody has to grow them. You know, you don't have to plant anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're just there. And if you can establish reasonable catch limits where you're not, you know, again, depriving seals and penguins and so forth, if we could get that under control and put those into the human food chain, I think that would be a pretty carbon-efficient way of eating.
Walk us through the process. Once these little silvery fish are caught, 25 million metric tons
yeah.
a year,
mm-hmm.
what happens after they're caught?
So they are put into basically a cooker and, a dryer and cooked over time to the point where you end up with this meal that's sort of like, it looks, sometimes people call it fish flour. It's sort of a brown meal. And then up until relatively recently, the oil was just burned off. And actually, in Norway, before they had an electrical grid, a lot of power plants and so forth, or homes even, ran on herring oil, interestingly mm. enough.
Mm.
And fish oil has a lot of weird, if I might make a digression, some of the listeners out there probably saw the movie Dunkirk. Interestingly, after Dunkirk, after the British, that major defeat, the first major offensive that the British launched against the Nazis, they assembled a team of Norwegian commandos and they slipped over to the Lofoten Islands in Norway to blow up a fish oil factory.
Hmm.
And why? Because fish oil is actually an essential ingredient in nitroglycerin explosives, which is why one of the reasons that we destroyed 390,000 of the 400,000 great whales of the Southern Ocean hmm. was for combination of either nitroglycerin or margarine. Actually,
hmm.
if you're older than 60, you probably have eaten whale at some point or another because you ate margarine. Anyway, so the meal is made from the sort of flesh of the fish. The oil is separated out, and increasingly now the oil is actually an additive for aquaculture feed and all these kinds of things. The other interesting thing that I came about that's maybe relevant to the California visitor is that this, or the California resident, is that this whole model of doing things with little fish, a lot of it was developed right here in California and particularly in Monterey. You know, we know all from the area know about Cannery Row and so forth. What we don't know is that while there was canning that went on in Cannery Row with those, all of those sardines and anchovies that were caught off that coast, a good amount of it was for fish feed. I mean, it was for animal feed and fertilizer. And there was, in the book, I talk about this, you know, this weird cat and mouse game that the regulators play with the fish meal and fish oil industry, where the regulators, they realize early on, we don't want to just take fish and turn them into, like, animal feed and fertilizer. We want people to eat them. So they keep trying to make these regulations. The California State Department of Fisheries keeps saying, okay, no, 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 you can't use sardines, Monterey sardines, for animal feed. And they're like, okay. So then the canneries start making elite brands of sardines that are boneless. So they cut the fillet down to like a minuscule portion of the fish so they have more guts and so forth that they can throw in the cooker and turn into animal feed, because the real center profit is animal feed. So then they're like, no, 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 you can't do that. That we can't, you're cheating on that. So then what they did in California is that they moved the processing out of state waters. So they had barges parked just outside state waters and federal waters running full-time 24-hour reduction facilities of California sardines. And those students of history who know that story know what happened. We completely crashed out the California sardine, which was an essential part of the marine ecosystem here. It's creeping back to viability now, but it crashed. And hey, where did all that infrastructure go? All those processing plants and boats, where did they all go? Peru. Mm. So now Peru is the center of the reduction industry, and that's where most of the oil for dietary supplements comes from, and that's where most of the aqua feed for growing salmon comes from.
When we're talking specifically about fish oil or omega-3 supplements, mm-hmm. it's a $15 billion industry. How many companies are we talking about?
I mean, it's a handful, you know, and I should clarify that the actual supplement, the pill, is probably more in the order of 2 to 3 billion. But then there are all these omega-3 supplemented products, you know, baby formula, all these other products out there.
And so as a citizen, if you're buying baby formula and it says omegas on the box, that means it's a supplemented product.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in fairness to the industry, a fair amount of the omega-3 supplementation that happens in infant formula is actually coming from algae, which is a potentially more sustainable source. But nevertheless, I mean, gosh, you know, there's so many digressions you can go to on this book, but I mean,
well, just luckily we have time.
Yeah, I mean, in keeping with the news, that recent move by the Trump administration to kind of basically, you know, unendorse breastfeeding is kind of remarkable, and actually is very intimately tied up in the omega-3 story, because, you know, you were asking, you know, as a vegan, do I really need to take this stuff? Well, it turns out that humans get omega-3s into their brains primarily at the beginning through breastfeeding. Because breast milk is rich in DHA omega-3 fatty acids. All women have the ability to elongate short chain vegetarian sources of omega-3. So you can eat leafy greens and so forth. All women can elongate the ALA, short chain fatty acids, and turn them into long chain. And it's important to note that the human brain. So the human brain is basically a piece of fat on a stick. The brain is a big mass of fat. Mm. And 10% of the human brain by mass are DHA omega-3 fatty acids. So this is why, actually, you know, there's a big controversy, like, do we need to eat seafood? There are whole indigenous populations that are isolated from Western diets that are eating a lot of leafy greens and so forth that don't eat any seafood at all, that have perfectly normal infants. Why? Well, probably because in the absence of all these confounding other foods that have omega-6 that interfere, we can talk about that later, but those people are eating leafy greens and so forth. Women in those populations are able to make those long-chain fatty acids and get them into the brains of their children through breastfeeding.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I was just thinking, I don't think I've had fish in something like 25 or 28 years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's possible to do, especially since, you know, as you say, you're a non-junk food vegan. One of the other confounding factors, and one of the interesting storylines that emerged in writing the Omega Principle, was this other omega, which is called the omega-6. And so the omega-6...
Can you hold that thought? We're going to take a quick break.
Yeah, no problem.
Today we're speaking with Paul Greenberg about his new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it is our One Planet series, and we are joined in studio by Paul Greenberg. He's out with a new book called The Omega Principle: Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Paul is also author of American Catch and the best-selling Four Fish. He has been writing about fish and seafood for about a decade now, and unfortunately, this is a pre-taped Your Call, so we can't take any of your phone calls. So we've been talking about omega-3s, and you wanted to also talk about omega-6s.
Yes. So, you know, every story has a hero and a villain. And in the omega-3 story, the unlikely villain is this other omega called the omega-6. And I should preface by saying it's not a true villain, because we actually need omega-6s as well as omega-3s in our body. But omega-3s and omega-6s actually compete in the human body. We were talking earlier about there are vegetable sources of omega-3s, but those are short-chain alpha-linolenic acid. I won't go into that too much. But the human body has an ability to elongate those vegetable sources and turn them into the long chains that are in our brains and so forth. Omega-6s, however, if they're omega-6s, which are generally coming to us from things like corn oil, soy oil, all of these sort of agricultural industrial products, if there's a lot of that, they compete for space on the same enzymes. If there are a lot of omega-6s, we can't as efficiently convert those vegetable sources of omega-3s into the heart-healthy and brain-healthy omega-3s. So this led me into this, like, you know, another interesting journey, which is to understand this larger competition between omega-3 world and omega-6 world. Because really, when we're talking about omega-6 world, I mean, and I should point out, not everybody buys this competition thing. I mean, they know that it exists, but how important it is a question. But there is definitely a competition between the hosts of foods that generally have an omega-3 profile and the hosts of foods that have a generally omega-6 profile. And who are these omega-6 foods? I mean, they're basically that, you know, basket of foods that we've learned about for the last 10 years, mostly through Michael Pollan, but corn, soy, corn-fed beef, soy-fed pigs, those are all going to have a fatty profile that's leaning towards omega-6. Whereas omega-3s tend to come to us from seafood, tend to come to us from leafy greens that might be grown on small farms. So interesting, remember after Trump was elected, the New York Times did this thing. They had Clinton's America and Trump's America. And you saw, you know, Clinton's America was this sort of rind of green on the edge of the continent. And then Trump's America was like dead set in the center. Well, more or less that conforms to omega-3 world versus omega-6 world. Hmm. So, and, you know, the tragedy of it all is that, you know, I think it was Steve Bannon who said that politics is downstream from culture, and that, you know, people, you know, sometimes in the heartland rally behind their diet, you know, their fast food and their meat and so forth. But it's actually making them sicker. Hmm. So to rally behind this whole omega-6 style of eating with feedlot beef, with corn and soy commodities powering a junk food industry, you're making yourself sicker. And actually embracing an omega-3 world with more seafood, with more leafy greens, with an eye towards protecting estuaries and living ecosystems that, you know, are good for us. Mm. It will be good for us and will be good for the planet.
Let's talk about some of the claims that are made by these companies and this massive industry.
Yeah.
You have a little tidbit of information that I found really interesting in your book. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch had put himself through college going door to door selling vitamins. And early on, he became a good congressional friend to the supplement industry. Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about the 1994 Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act.
Yeah. And this is also called the Proxmire Amendment. But basically what happened was, the whole story is, back in the, you know, probably the 70s, Linus Pauling, who we all probably remember from our science textbooks, who was a big advocate, was a big, very important scientist in the development of research around DNA, he started going cuckoo for vitamin C and recommending these mega doses, you know, 3,000 milligrams, 4,000 milligrams. And all of a sudden, the FDA started to take note and say, you know, we don't really know what the effect is of these super high dosages. And so they started trying to change the way that we regulated vitamins and so forth. Then people like Orrin Hatch, who, as you said, you know, went door to door as a kid, or as a college kid, put himself through college by selling vitamins. And interestingly enough, most of the supplement companies out there are based in Utah. And I was wondering that out loud on the radio when I was on Fresh Air, and I was like, I think at the time I said, "Geez, I don't know why all these supplement companies are in Utah." And somebody on Facebook said, "Well, you know, a lot of Mormons go door to door selling religion, so they have the built-in skill already going door to door." Anyway, Orrin Hatch came along and at the supplement company's behest said, "You know, no, we can't limit dosage amounts. No, we should come up with something else." So in the process, what happened was a third category was established within FDA. So there's foods, there's drugs, and now there's dietary supplements, which one author calls a sort of hermaphroditic quality or category that's neither food nor drug. And it really has very little regulation on it at all.
And you report that no supplement makers could put whatever they want in a capsule and sell it as a supplement. No science or evidence of any kind is necessary. I take quite a few supplements.
Uh-huh.
And the bottles always say this has not been approved by the FDA.
That's right. It was funny. I was sitting down with Marion Nestle a few weeks ago, who's, you know, listeners might know, wrote Food Politics, a great, you know, researcher. And we were talking about the placebo effect, that when you are taking something that you think helps you, oftentimes you do get better. And the placebo effect should not be discounted. It does actually have an effect. My father-in-law, he's like 92. Still running a construction business. When I told him I was writing a book about omega-3s, he was thrilled because he's like totally into supplements. And, you know, he's like, "All right, get a pen, write it down. This is what I take. 2 grams of fish oil, 4 grams of probiotic, 3 grams, you know," and just went down the whole list. And the reason he does all this is because his father developed Alzheimer's in his 70s and went off the deep end and never recovered. And Phil Drill, my father-in-law, 92, still running a construction company, Drill Construction, and
that's,
you know,
great.
He's pretty sharp. And so I don't want to say that supplements don't have a place in our lives, but, you know, the other thing that's important to remember is one of the reasons that the supplement industry has grown as it's grown is because medical research itself has become corrupted. There, in earlier times, in the heyday of the success of the FDA, there was such a thing as objective studying of drugs, and there still is, but more and more we're starting to see industry-sponsored trials of drugs. And of course, when you have an industry that's backing a particular drug, they want to see positive results. My partner is she's a statistical geneticist, and she does a lot of statistics, and she looks at a lot of trials, and inevitably there are companies calling and they look at the results, and these are not unintelligent people, and they say, "Well, you know, couldn't we do this and show a little more effect and da 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 da." This is filtering down, I think, to the consumers like you, right? You probably raise an eye when you see a drug company's ad and da da da, and you're like, "I don't want any part of it. I want a supplement. I want something that is natural.
Right.
I want the nature to heal me." And maybe you're getting a nice placebo effect.
Supporting a good local company that, has local workers. And
yep.
All right. So when we look at the scientific research about the health benefits of omega-3s, what does it say?
Well, so even this week, Cochrane just came out with a big meta-analysis. And what's a meta-analysis? It's an analysis of analyses. It's a study of studies. And the most recent one, just like some other earlier ones that came out the last few years, have shown no effect on cardiovascular health from omega-3 fatty acids. Now, I say this with a little bit of pause because I'm in touch with the omega-3 people, with the Global Organization of EPA and DHA Fatty Acids. I attended their conference at the Ritz-Carlton in the Canary Islands. And they always like to point out that when these studies come out that show no effect, they don't take into account the fact that now we have statins, now we have stents, we have all these other ways of intervening on cardiovascular disease that we didn't have when omega-3s first came onto the market. I should note that there were randomized control trials at the early stages of omega-3s, and they did show considerable effect. One of the reasons they may not be showing effect now is because we have these other ways of treating heart disease that we didn't have at the time. On brain health, on joint health, there are all kinds of studies. They're all across the board. Some show effect, some don't show effect. I think as we do more studies and look at things, my hunch is that we're going to, in the end, show more effect having to do with the brain than with the heart, precisely because so much of the brain is actually composed of this stuff. Whether supplementation will work, I don't know, but I think that that's going to be something for future reference. And before we move on from this topic, it is important to note there's a giant, giant, giant randomized control trial study coming out in November, and maybe we should check back in then, called the VITAL study. And that's coming from Brigham and Women's Hospital. And it's one of the largest randomized control trials ever done. I think it's, you know, tens of thousands of subjects taking lots of fish oil. And they're going to really look at cardiovascular health, at brain health, and all these kinds of things. When that study comes out, I think we will have something of a definitive opinion on whether these things work or not.
Paul Greenberg is author of The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Every year, citizens spend $15 billion on omega-3 supplements and omega-3 supplemented products, and that could include baby formula. I'm sure that you've seen the claims. Maybe your doctor or dietitian has said you really need omega-3s, lots and lots of health benefits, coronary heart disease, increasing brain volume, building muscle in adults. It's a very long list. And Paul is here for a pre-taped conversation, so unfortunately, we can't take your phone calls. You know, the other thing, Paul, that's so interesting is we are bombarded with all these ads and there's all these books about what to take and what to eat. Now, what if, and this happened to me, if you get an extensive blood test and your doctor says you're low in these areas, you definitely need omega-3s.
Well, so interestingly enough, so I, as part of the research for this book, put myself onto an all-fish diet for a year where I ate fish for every single meal for a year. And halfway through the experiment, I found out that actually there is a test for omega-3 fatty acids in your blood. It's this company called Omega Quant, and you can get your finger pricked and they will tell you your fatty acid levels. And by the end of my experiment, I should say I had the blood of a Sicilian fisherman, probably from like circa 1875. there is an association between high omega-3 levels and low coronary heart disease and lower chronic disease. And so I do think that there is something to that. I think that keeping your omega-3 levels maybe in a decent range, I think, you know, most Americans are below 5%, and I think you want to be kind of above 7%. I think there might be something to it, but I also think that fish offer so many different other kinds of nutrients that to just look at it in the form of just one nutrient, I think, might be a mistake.
So I'm taking a vegetarian version of omega-3s.
Uh-huh.
What is that, and where does that come from?
So oftentimes it's coming from algae. So I should point out, so there are, sometimes people take flax, for example. Mm-hmm. But flax and most vegetable sorts, most land-based vegetable sources of omega-3s are not EPA or DHA, not long-chain fatty acids. They tend to be these short-chain alpha-linolenic acids. However, as we spoke of at the beginning of the show, the ultimate creators of these long-chain fatty acids are algae, marine phytoplankton. And now we do have companies that are producing omega-3 supplements from algae. And those can be relatively, I mean, particularly ecologically neutral or even potentially benign. It depends how you grow them. A lot of algae supplements are made from the fermentation of sugarcane cuttings. And you're basically algae can do both respiration and photosynthesis. And so what these companies often do is push the respiration side of things because it's much more efficient. And so they actually have to feed them something. There was one company I came across in Texas called Almega, which only used the photosynthesis, which I kind of prefer because then you're not having to feed them anything. Anyway, long story short, if you're having long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, EPA or DHA, that is of a vegetable source, chances are it's coming from algae.
And how do we know that these companies are being honest about their claims? I mean, if supplement makers can put whatever they want in a capsule and sell it as a supplement, I was reading the Nordic Naturals box because they're one of the big fish oil companies.
Yeah.
And basically it says, we're environmentally correct. We're sustainable. Mm-hmm. We're doing everything right. How do we know that, especially when we're talking about a company that is taking so much out of the ocean?
Yeah. Well, generally speaking, most companies that are selling fish oil are selling, a lot of times it's Peruvian anchoveta. And Peruvian anchoveta is better managed than it was. In the 1970s, when the military government took control of Peru, they really went gangbusters on that stock of fish. In recent years, they've switched to quota systems. I won't get too technical on the fisheries management, but suffice to say they're doing it better. But one of the things I always say is that, you know, every single one of these reduction fisheries, these reduction companies that reduce 25 million metric tons to dust and oil, each of them will say they're sustainable. Each of them will say, well, we're managing this in a sustainable way. But when you add them all up and all the fish that are being taken for production, it's still 20 to 25 million metric tons, the human weight of the United States. So you can't help but scratch your head and think, what if there were 25 million metric tons of fish in the ocean that is primary forage for all these predator fish and whales and seals and so forth? What would the ocean look like if we kept those 25 million metric tons in the ocean? I should say also there is a way to get omega-3s from fish without killing any fish directly, which is that, you know, the Alaska salmon industry, which I generally support, it's a very well-regulated fishery. There was this funny story in the book where Martha Stewart was visiting a fish processor up in Alaska named Sandro Lane, this guy who made some of the first Alaskan lox, basically. And so Martha Stewart was visiting the facility, and she saw all the guts and stuff going basically into the garbage. And she turned to Sandra Lane, who ran this company, and she said, "Can you do anything with all these guts?" And Sandra was like, "Huh, maybe we could." And he actually started this whole company called Pure Alaska Omega, where they took all the guts of the salmon that otherwise would have just been dumped and turned it into a high-grade fish oil. And there's a lot of benefits in that because one of the problems with these reduction companies that use wild fish harvesting, because they're harvesting for animal feed and fertilizer as well, they don't always refrigerate what they're catching. And since omega-3s are very, very active compounds, if you don't keep them under refrigeration, they can oxidize, which basically means they can rot. Meanwhile, a food fish fishery, salmon, you're keeping fish cold from the beginning, and so if you're using offcuts from the salmon industry, chances are there's a good chance they would have been refrigerated and kept cool and not oxidized. So
today we're speaking with Paul Greenberg, author of the new book, The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Paul has been writing about fish and oceans for about a decade, and for this book, he ate fish for a year, and the findings are pretty fascinating. Before we go there, though, what I like about the book is you cover so much ground. I mean, in addition to writing about the omega-3 supplement industry and omega-3 supplemented products industry, which is $15 billion a year, you write about fats, about protein. This is really interesting because protein has also become something that is being sold to us. I mean, the biggest question that the vegans get is, where do you get your protein, right? And I love to say, well, where do cows get their protein? They eat grass. But so you write, if there is a macronutrient of the moment, surely protein is it. Protein is promoted everywhere in whey-based supplements, energy bars, breakfast cereal packaging. But when you dig into dietary recommendations, it turns out that our need for protein is actually relatively small.
That's right. Yeah, you need about 100 grams a day if you're a man, 60 to 70 if you're a woman. And what does that come out to? 100 grams of protein is the equivalent of one thin McDonald's hamburger per day. Not a Big Mac, but like when you get the child size, the little burger, that's all you need.
Wow.
And one of the reasons that we've become so obsessed with protein is that the human body doesn't actually store protein very well. We just tend to piss it out. And actually, this came to my attention, this whole overeating of protein came to my attention from somebody at the New England Aquarium. I think Michael Tuesday is his name. And he wrote an op-ed called Pissing Away Sustainability. And literally, that's what we're doing. So all these people you hear about, the zone and all these high meat-based diets, the reason they work is because we eat a lot of protein. It gives us that feeling of satiety. And then we piss it away, which I think is really a tragedy. Meanwhile, though, when you double back again to the Mediterranean diets and the research done around that, those super healthy diets with super long life expectancy and low chronic disease have very low amounts of animal protein, probably on the order of what, you know, those low levels that the USDA recommends.
What happens if you eat too much protein, which if you're on a standard American diet, you definitely are eating a lot of protein?
So I can't really speak to the epidemiological deficit, you know, what is the damage of too much protein. But what I will say is that too much animal animal mass in your eating too much animals seems to be correlated with a lot of different problems, ranging from cardiovascular disease to cancer and to decreased lifespan. Mm. So there are all these things that seem to be associated. And I have to point out, you know, that dietary studies are tough. It's really hard to prove that a diet 100% does this.
Right.
And so most of the research that is done through association studies. In other words, this population is sort of eating this, and they're sort of having these kind of life outcomes. We think it might be because they're eating this, but generally speaking, like somebody who's, you know, a pescatarian, somebody who's eating some fish, generally they're going to be also probably wealthier. They're probably going to exercise more. So it's hard to figure out exactly what are the things that are making you live longer and have fewer diseases.
And we're all so different. I mean, yes. You know, the other thing that this blood test showed is, you know, I have some issues based on genetics. And
I'm
the
sure.
doctor said this could come from 200 or 500 years ago.
Yeah.
You could, you know, you could be eating the best, quote, best diet based on what you think it is, but you still might have some issues down the road.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I thought about a lot in this book was human evolution.
Mm.
And keep in mind that we only pass along the genes that bring us to the age of reproduction. Beyond that, you know, we don't really, you know, balding and so forth, either that doesn't affect our reproduction later in life because we already reproduce. So we just suffer that no matter the case.
Mm.
What is interesting to note is that when we switch from being hunter-gatherers to the planters of corn and soy and wheat and so forth, that produced a tremendous burst in calories, which allowed us to have many more offspring and allowed those offspring to have more offspring. But it didn't do anything. It could have possibly favored younger, more energy intensive young people rather than healthier longevity type people. So this infusion of corn and soy and these high energy foods might not have been the best thing for us in terms of longevity, but they just made more people possible.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to ask about animal ag and then your fish experiment.
Yeah.
One in every four fish caught on Earth is reduced into oil and meal and used for agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I should say it's really one out of every 4 pounds.
Every four pounds.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, so this reduction industry that developed originally actually to reduce whales into margarine and nitroglycerin, but it's now evolved to reduce little fish. It's gone through this series of steps. And the very early phases of it, we used it as fertilizer as we started to exhaust our soils in the Northern Hemisphere. We used these fish from the Southern Hemisphere to prop them up. Then we figured out how to make nitrogen-based fertilizers through fossil fuel. And then we started, but we still caught all these fish, and then we started feeding to chickens. And then we fed it to pigs. And we fed them to pigs because when we started taking pigs and weaning the piglets at a much earlier age, they didn't get enough DHA omega-3 fatty acids through breastfeeding or through nursing, and so we gave them fish instead. So it's all linked into confined animal feeding operations. Now, 80 to 90% of the fish meal and fish oil that we're reducing is actually going to salmon and aquaculture, which is the fastest growing food system on the planet.
Right. And it's also fascinating to learn. I really want to do a show about aquaculture.
Yeah.
You write, aquaculture, the human-guided husbandry of everything from kelp to codfish, since the 80s has been the fastest growing food system on the planet, and one of the primary justifications for the growth is the purported need for more omega-3s in the Western diet.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I had this funny conversation at a reading I did in New York where somebody got up and asked a question. He said, yeah, you know, I used to take salmon, but now I take squid. I'm like, You take salmon or you eat salmon? It's like, well, no, I mean I eat it. But many Americans really just see fish as a nutraceutical.
Hmm.
But let's get out of that framework and let's really look at fish as food. And actually, when you compare growing fish to growing, say, cattle, and again, I know you're a vegan.
It's okay.
But growing fish, and particularly shellfish like clams and mussels and oysters, is actually so much more carbon efficient.
Yes.
And even salmon farming, which, you know, I know justifiably oftentimes has gotten a lot of criticism, salmon farming is much more carbon efficient, much more freshwater efficient, much more open space efficient than pretty much any animal husbandry we do on land. Mm. So it's important to remember and keep those things in context.
We have only have a couple minutes left. Yeah. So you had fish for a year.
Yep.
And you had a lot of mercury.
I did. I had high mercury levels. Blood. In fact, I was talking to somebody at the Alaska State Department of Health who told me that if he'd ever seen mercury samples as high as mine, he would have sent somebody out to my village and told me to stop eating so much whale blubber.
Wow.
They were quite high. They were up to 5 parts per million. And so we—
Did you feel any different?
No. I didn't feel
I wonder if it would have been long term. Who knows?
It's hard to say. Huh. I have to tell you, I'm a little bit of a skeptic on the hysteria around mercury because why? Because we kind of have a randomized controlled trial in the form of Japan, where, you know, we eat 15 pounds of seafood a year. They eat 150 pounds. Like, do you think of Japan as an impaired country? Like, I don't. But anyway, nevertheless, I did have high mercury. When I cut back to 2 portions of seafood a week, the problem went away.
And again, depending on where you live, you can have a completely different answer. I mean, as a vegan, I would never advocate not eating fish if you live on the Big Island or in the Caribbean or whatever. Yep. But Sylvia Earle, who's an amazing ocean advocate, says we cannot eat any more fish if you have the means to buy other things. What do you eat at this point after reporting on these issues for 10 years?
So I have adopted what the term I coined is a pescatarian diet. So it's a Mediterranean diet, which means very little animal protein, maybe a couple times a week. But the primary source of that animal protein is coming from the sea. And which things do I eat from the sea? I try to favor things like mussels, clams, and oysters, filter feeders. And then I also try to favor these small pelagics that otherwise would have gone into the reduction chain. So anchovies, sardines, things like that. That, to me, works out pretty well. I mean, I do stray. Certainly when I go out, I eat my share of meat when I'm being invited out on the town. But I try to stay away from the meat.
Well, since you're here in San Francisco, you should go to Shizen in the Mission. It's vegan sushi from the other ocean, we like to say. And it's pretty amazing.
Okay.
It's not just avocado and cucumber. You should check it out.
I'll give it a shot.
Okay. Paul Greenberg is author of The Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for a Long Life and a Healthier Planet. Paul has been writing about fish and the oceans for 10 years. He's also author of American Catch and Four Fish. Paul, thank you for your reporting and thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much, Rose. Thanks for the thorough read. I appreciate
of
it.
Of course. Thank you so much. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. Thanks to Malihe Brazazan for producing today's show, and thanks to Laura Wenis for line producing. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.